Hello and welcome to another episode of the Student Loan Planner Podcast. This is Travis Hornsby. Today we're going to talk about a bunch of listener questions that you've got out there. And we're also going to talk about key deadlines to know in 2023 and coming up in 2024 about student loans that you've really got to pay attention to. Super, super important episode today. I'm going to start off with just a bunch of listener questions. We're going to go rapid fire. I think some of these will be interesting to you, but if they're not, you can always fast forward to the spot where we talk about the key deadlines to know for this year and next for student loans. So let's have our first listener question.
Mississippi, I am eligible for forgiveness under PSLF in 5 months' time, and I was wondering if you could speak to whether or not there is likely to be a tax bomb at the state level for borrowers who live in Mississippi. Rumor is that we will have to pay taxes on PSLF. I'm eligible for $200,000 of loans to be forgiven, so I would love it if you could speak to that. Thank you. Bye.
This is really interesting for a lot of reasons. When you get student loan forgiveness, you're supposed to get something called a 1099-C. But what's really interesting is with the Biden administration's American Rescue Plan, they've stopped sending those 1099-Cs out to people when they get the loans discharged. So Mississippi is an example of a state that does tax student loan forgiveness. If you don't get a 1099-C, then how is the state of Mississippi going to know? So first of all, I have to say I'm not a licensed tax advisor, so you have to consult with yours. This is kind of my thought. Check with your tax advisor. If you're in a situation, if you're getting $200,000 forgiven, Mississippi's got a 5% state income tax, it's 10 grand. You know, it's very possible that PSLF specifically isn't taxable in Mississippi. You got to just double check with your tax advisor to see if it is or it isn't. It's kind of like operating a cash lawn service business. There's massive underreporting that goes on. It's not legal, but it happens. I'm not advocating for that, but I'm saying that's probably what would happen in this situation. A lot of times people say, well, should I do XYZ? Well, it's like, well, you should do the right thing. It's also probably true that if you make an honest mistake, they're not going to catch you. And if you make a dishonest mistake, they probably won't catch you. Department of Education has no money for sort of enforcement right now and no money for auditing anybody, which is why just really crazy things have happened. Like, for example, there was a Government Accountability Office study that came out that said that one person had listed their family size was 93. So in other words, this person said they had, you know, a spouse and 92 children, and it took the Department of Education years to find out that that was not accurate. So there's all kinds of stuff like that out there. I would say not to stress about this. I mean, obviously, if you can get rid of $200,000 and the cost is 10 grand of taxes, it's not great. You obviously would prefer it to be zero, but it's probably survivable, right? Now, if I was in one of these states, so a lot of these states that do tax forgiveness are kind of smaller states. If I was a physician, you know, you're a prominent person in society just by virtue of your education and your profession, or you're a veterinarian or whatever it is, I would call your local state representative. And, you know, they get calls all the time about hot button issues. Whenever they get a call about some really boring, weird issue, they probably like talking about that because it's the kind of thing that you possibly could get bipartisan consensus on and just say that you're working for constituents, right? So I would just advocate people bring these kind of things up to their state representatives and their state senators. It really could make a difference, believe it or not. So now let's have another listener question.
Hello. We had a consultation a little over a year ago with Megan. It showed that we've been in repayment since around 95. We followed the instructions to consolidate and do everything we needed to do according to Megan's instructions, and she indicated everything was all set. We have about $112,000 in loans that, according to the payment count, whenever we get it, should be forgiven based on IDR. We're coming up on September when payments are due, and we still don't have a payment count. I saw there was an announcement today with a lot of forgiveness coming through. When can we expect to get our final payment count? We're getting very, very nervous.
I can hear the nervousness in that listener's voice. I understand a little bit of where you're coming from in the sense of my wife and I, did not get forgiveness because we got bad information and missed out on six figures that we could have had in our pockets instead. So I can't say that I understand this particular case for this listener, but I have sympathy for him. I think that the thing that people have to realize with Department of Education right now is they have no money. They promised the moon, right? So basically, they've given the equivalent of JFK's "We're going to the moon" speech, but instead of $100 billion from NASA to do it, they have nothing. They have no money. And they're promising all these things, and they're looking at the servicers who are paid like minimum cost awarded contracts, who also these servicers are dropping out right and left of the program. And they're looking at these servicers, and then they're saying, you know, oh yeah, you go do these things that we just promised the world we're going to do for no money. And so far, this is actually working, honestly, better than I would have expected, because they're just pressing the easy button over at Department of Ed in a lot of cases, but that easy button takes a while for them to press. So I think that what you could expect for the payment count is if you're going to be forgiven right away, those are the folks that are going to get the first look, if you will. Now, if this person's been in payment since 95, you know, the question is, you know, what should that payment count be? I'm going to guess maybe that maybe some there's some grad loans mixed in. Maybe there's not. But if there are, that's 25 years, right? So then you'd be have to be paying since 1998, which person said that they were. Now, on top of that, are there any in-school deferments mixed in? If there are in-school deferments mixed in, that could easily be a four-year period. And so then you'd have to be talking 1994, right? So someone in this situation, I'm not saying this is the exact situation they're in, but what could happen is effectively, if you're not fully at the finish line yet, you might be really close. But what we've seen with the PSLF waiver that happened is they forgave everybody that were already past the finish line first. And then they went back much later and updated everybody's payment count with PSLF. You know, the thing to realize about the IDR waiver or IDR count adjustment is that there are no systems in place to track anyone's payment count right now. And Department of Ed has zero ability to get the money they need to put this payment count tracker up on the federal website, at least for several years. I know that that's not at all a calming statement to make. But what I would say is if I was in this borrower's shoes, I'd try to figure out what is my minimum monthly payment I possibly can make. If I think I qualify for forgiveness, some sort of forbearance program might be in order to put off making payments. Any payments that you overpay will be refunded. And the question of, can any of this be reversed? No, because it's just something that Department of Ed is already committed to. And when you've already committed to this big of a thing, you can't really undo it bureaucratically very easily at all. I know it's easy for me to sit here and preach patience, but that's what you have to be willing to do in this case. It's not at all pleasant. It's not fun. But it's kind of like pretend you're like getting audited by the IRS. It's very stressful and you have to file a response. You file the response and you don't hear from them for 18 months. You did your part. Now you just have to sit back and wait and you will get a good resolution. Now let's listen to a question from a listener about Kaiser Permanente now qualifying for PSLF. I'm going to paraphrase this because the listener put some personal identifying information in there. But this person basically is asking, what do we need to do? We heard where everybody's talking at work that we can now get loan forgiveness. What should we do and how do we do it? So what you need to realize is there has to be a, to qualify, if you're working at a 1099 or a kind of a for-profit physicians group, but you actually work for a place like Kaiser Permanente, Kaiser's not-for-profit, but a lot of these employer groups are not not-for-profit. What the PSLF regulations specifically say is if your state has a law that specifically bars the direct employment of your profession, then that means that you can get PSLF and that can be a qualifying employer. And so that means that you have to be in this affected professional group. So the person who asked this question was actually a physical therapist. I'm not sure that there's any specific state laws that prohibit the direct employment of physical therapists in a state like California. I'd have to double check that. I would double check that if so this person was doing a consult with us. But for physicians, I know that there's a state law that prohibits direct employment of physicians in California and Texas because we've dealt with that problem for several years. And we've been talking on this podcast specifically about why people need to basically not refinance their federal student loans as soon as we realized what the Biden administration was thinking about trying to do, just because of the big uncertainty surrounding whether or not that they would be successful in enacting this. And so far, they seem to be not only successful in making this a qualifying employer for a lot of people, but they're also claiming this is going to be retroactive. That's a showstopper. They're saying essentially that anyone who's affected by this can get retroactive credit, rewriting the rules back in history to make Kaiser qualifying. And you've got to submit all the documents before the end of the year because that's when the IDR count adjustment's over with. So this is a incredibly intense time for anybody who's going through all these regulations. I've actually had a reader write in who applied for PSLF under the account adjustment in June, was a Kaiser employee, got denied, and felt like, okay, well, I don't qualify. And I said, wait, Do you know that the effective date of these regulations is July 1st and you applied in June? Therefore, in June, you didn't qualify, even though they'd already announced that you would qualify, because you didn't apply after the effective date of the regulations, which was July 1. So he's going to reapply. Now he's going to get it. But if he didn't reapply, he might not have gotten it because he has to consolidate a bunch of stuff. So goodness sakes, has there ever been a system that's more stupidly designed than the way that we built our student loan system? We, every, you know, as Americans. I mean, I'm not singling out one administration. Probably not. It's like a, I don't know. It's a big mess. So let's go ahead and listen to another listener question.
Hi, my name is Christian. I'm trying to sign up for PSLF. This is my fifth year teaching. So I had 1 year of payments, and then we had the COVID pause for about 3.5 years. My dilemma is that I was under the wrong payment plan. I signed up for the graduated 10-year payments. So my dilemma is also that I, last year, I just now discovered that there was a PSLF waiver I could have signed up for, and I didn't know about that. So my question is, this new waiver this year that isn't PSLF exactly, will this retroactively help me now? Or am I still kind of out of luck with that? Do I need to consolidate or not with that? Thank you.
So it's not too late for the IDR account adjustment, is the technical name for it, to basically be your own personal PSLF waiver. So you can get both. The way you get both is if you are like this person who's a teacher, you can consolidate. The question is, should you? If you have about the same income that you had in 2018, then yeah, you probably can consolidate without any issue at all, and just the same plan's fine. But if you have a very different income, the question mark there is, do you need to consolidate? So let me give you an example. So say you have, you know, $40,000 of Stafford loans that are unconsolidated, and your required payment on your income-based plan is like, you know, $20 a month. That was back when you made income for like a couple months out of the year, when you certified your income last, but now your payment would be $300 a month. Well, if you consolidate, are you getting any benefit from it? If you're not getting any benefit from it, then don't consolidate, because all you're doing is taking that $20 a month payment and resetting it to be $300 a month. So the person in this case just needs to probably go to our, if they, obviously, if you can get a consult with us, that's probably better. But if you can't, go to studentloanplanner.com, go to our save calculator on the website. It's under the calculator section, and then calculate what your payment will be based on your most recent tax return. If that payment is less than what you're currently scheduled to be doing, then go ahead and consolidate for sure. If it's about the same, go ahead and consolidate. If it's much higher, probably don't consolidate. But either way, you can still get the impacts of the PSLF waiver with this IDR account adjustment until the end of the year. That's the deadline. So I want to do another listener question, but this one I'm going to paraphrase again. So this person was basically wondering that they're at 16 years into IBR, and they're real scared that they're going to get left behind. So they don't have, you know, any proof that they are on a forgiveness tracker. They're just sort of thinking, you know, I didn't get that message everybody else got, you know, that's ready for forgiveness. So am I in trouble? Am I going to actually get it? Is it really going to happen to me? Again, I would just preach patience. We are years away, years from having a IDR account tracker that's not PSLF specific, because they've never built it before. This IDR account adjustment is really trying to, it's very smart the way they designed it, but it's really trying to sort of aggressively move the goalposts as to how they originally defined the income-driven rules in a way that's good for borrowers. So they're trying to really aggressively calculate what people's forgiveness credit should be. And the best way that they're able to give you as much credit as possible in general is if you consolidate. Because if you consolidate, they don't have to go look up each individual loan as what it should be. They just look at the one big loan, and they're just going to try to apply the most generous possible credit that they can give you based off of whatever loan that you have is the absolute oldest. So for example, you know, there's a something like, I think it's 4 million people that have about $211 billion in debt that they've had for at least 20 years. Is all of this debt been around for 20 years? No. A lot of it is for people going back to school, for grad programs, or for Parent Plus loans and things like that. So the opportunity with IDR account adjustment is by consolidating all this debt together, you're getting credit for that consolidated loan based off whatever loan is the oldest. So that oldest loan could be a $3,000 loan. You could have $300,000 in debt. It doesn't matter. That new consolidated loan is going to get credited based off of the oldest loan that you got. So that's an enormous opportunity. You probably can do more damage by not consolidating than by consolidating. That's probably true. There are some situations, though, where, you know, you're a person that had a $0 a month payment, and you're giving that up in exchange for a $1,000 a month payment if you're a high-income professional by consolidating when you didn't need to. So just a lot of different ways that you can save money right now. I just take a deep breath. We'll cover more of these types of questions to try to help you make the best decision here. For this listener question, I'm going to paraphrase it, actually, because it's a sensitive issue, perhaps. This person was on pay, got kicked off against her will, put on the standard plan, and is trying to fight to get put back on pay because of a bunch of servicer changes that occurred. I think that for this case, you need to know about the ombudsman email. So the ombudsman email is sort of an email to use kind of like as a last resort kind of thing. It's not something that I would recommend leading with, but it's ombudsman@ed.gov. So ombudsman@ed.gov. I would be a little careful about that email because you don't want to escalate something immediately to DEFCON 4 or whatever the top DEFCON is, because you want to start with the process of trying to get it fixed through the servicer, right? You can also file a complaint with the CFPB portal. I think that's a very effective way to get it done. I would probably say the first line of defense is just to ask the servicer to correct it over the phone or email. If they don't do it promptly, file a complaint at the CFPB and see if that fixes your issue. And you can literally just type in CFPB complaint and then file that. And then if you're still not getting an issue and it's a really advanced problem, you would just do ombudsman@ed.gov and be mindful of what kind of problem it is. You know, if it's I'm missing half my loans in my NSLDS file. If it's my servicer incorrectly pulled me off of the pay plan. Now, remember, the pay plan, sometimes, you know, you have a standard plan that's a capped payment too. So sometimes, you know, that's okay for them to do that because they're just following the rules. But it sounds like in this case, they didn't actually do that. So for this last one, this is, I think, a real call, but I just thought it was kind of funny. So we're going to play it anyway. So here it is.
Hey, what's up? I work at one of the loan servicers. And I mean, I've never heard any of your podcasts before, but I'm going on a road trip and I'm excited. Anyway, I got questions. What are the worst horror stories you've heard of, like, a customer service rep? You or people you help. Have a good one.
First of all, let me say to the hardworking men and women that are competent at the loan servicers, thank you for your service. It's a very thankless job. It's a difficult job. And I think that you're not really given the resources to do a good job at your job for the most part. So that said, in terms of like horror stories, I've got a ton. There are some people that really, really love working at the loan servicers and helping people. And then there are people that it's just like a job to them. And it's like, whatever, $20 a month, $25 a month. So, you know, some of the horror stories. I remember back when I first started doing this, there was some woman who I called in with a client because they told the client incorrectly they weren't eligible for pay as you earn. And I knew that they were. And so we called the loan servicer and she was like, I am a pay as you earn expert, like senior black belt expert. You know, I know what I'm doing and I do not appreciate being told that I don't understand these payment programs. You know, I know exactly what they qualify for. They do not qualify. They were wrong, but it was just the confidence was just really impressive. And sometimes I'm wrong on things too. So, you know, I hope that I'm humble when I'm wrong on things, but it was pretty funny just how offended they were by just like me asking for a review about pay as you earn eligibility for a client. That was way back in the day where I was doing all the calls myself. So that's like 7 years ago, I think. A couple other horror stories. I guess, you know, sometimes people are like, some of the loan servicer people can be, and I think maybe because they get yelled at a lot, but they can sometimes be really condescending to clients. Like, I don't know, like almost like judgy or something like that. I've had people be a little insulting about how much debt people have had. I'm just trying to think. Yeah, it's just a tough job, right? So I would probably imagine it's probably similar to being an airline customer support representative during like the pandemic peak disruptions in 21 and 2022. You don't wish that job on your worst enemy, but you know, people had to do it and people did it, right? So thank you again to you loan servicer folks out there. If anybody listens to the pod, thanks for, I guess, listening to this and trying to be part of the solution instead of part of the problem, trying to develop your expertise. I mean, certainly people will really, I think, appreciate you being aware of some of this stuff. I think that's pretty much all the questions we'll do. So we're going to talk about some deadlines next. So here we come with the important student loan deadlines to know in 2023 and 2024. The first one is the refund deadline. So about August 30th, 2023, you will no longer, I think, be able to get a refund for payments made during the student loan pause. So that's March of 2020 until August 30th. If I wanted to try to get a refund of any kind, be it something I partially paid off or fully paid off, you know, you might as well take the chance. So basically, you're supposed to just give a call to the loan servicer, ask for the refund. Sometimes it's very complicated because your servicer might be a servicer doesn't exist anymore. It was a prior servicer and they have to create a new account and, you know, add the loans to that old place. I mean, it's not easy. Just be aware that that August 30th-ish deadline is the last opportunity to try to ask for a refund, I think. So that's something to kind of really be cognizant of. Student loan interest starts again September 1. So if you're a glutton for punishment, I guess, you could call up your servicer and ask if you've, you know, September 2, if you actually accrued some interest. I'm just joking. Don't do that. You hopefully have more fun things to do. I think that's around Labor Day weekend, sometime in there. So that's one thing to think about. Your first payment is not going to be pulled out, though, until October 1st. So that's the first actual payment deadline that's going to be coming out. So for most people, I would say probably 80, 90% of people that were on an IDR plan before the pandemic, you'll probably have a lower payment than what you would have expected if you had to recertify with current income. For most people, I think that's the case. Now, for people who recently graduated in the past, it's kind of funny to say recent, in the past 3.5 years of the pause, you know, you might need to get signed up for something. It is really interesting the way they're doing these deadlines. So, you know, pay as you earn requires you to be a new borrower as of 2007. Simplifying a little bit, but that's what it requires. New IBR is it requires you to be a new borrower as of July 2014. So anybody who took out a loan for anything before 2014 is not a new borrower for IBR. And so anybody who borrowed for the first time before 2007 is not a new borrower for pay. So what that means is there is a massive amount of borrowers in this in-between group that started undergrad anytime between 2007 and 2014. If you did and took out at least one loan, you've got a deadline I'm going to talk about in a second. Before I talk about that deadline, I want to talk about the December 31st deadline. That deadline is the last deadline to consolidate to still be considered for the IDR account adjustment. So if you don't consolidate by December 31st and you needed to, too bad, so sad, because they will still look at your weighted average credit, but they're not going to do what we talked about of taking the oldest loan and just adding that total credit to the whole thing. So if you need to consolidate by December 31st, you got to do it or else it's just too late. That's the message we're trying to get out there to people. So now I want to talk about that July 2024 deadline. That's the deadline for those folks in that giant canyon of people who borrowed from 2007 to 2014. The reason why this is so important is if you don't get up on pay as you earn by that date, by that deadline, it's gone forever. You cannot access pay as you earn unless you're signed up by July 2024. Now, who needs to pay attention to this? If you are needing to sign up for it on that by that deadline, then you know what you're giving up by not getting on it is 20-year forgiveness versus 25-year forgiveness. So do not underestimate how valuable that is. So for example, if you're a physician in private practice or you're a dentist or you're a veterinarian or a lawyer, your income is probably exponential or at least has a higher than average, higher than inflation level growth. And so if you think about the impact of paying for an additional 5 years, that impact is enormous. It's probably way more money than the $100 to $200 a month you'd save being on the save plan versus pay. So that's a massive deadline. I think it's going to keep us extremely busy from January to July of 2024. Now, from July 2024 to July 2025, we've got the double consolidation deadline. So no more Parent Plus loans are allowed to qualify for save until after July of 2025. Now, that is a really scary deadline, because if you think about what the consequence of missing it is, if you're a Parent Plus borrower, it means you have to do 20% of your income with 100% poverty line deduction instead of 10% of your income with a 225% poverty line deduction. So what does that mean in practice? So you're effectively talking about only being able to deduct $14,000 instead of $32,000 before you have to pay anything. And then over and above that level, you'd have to pay 20% of the amount of income above that level versus 10%. So for example, a person with a 40K income, a retiree, that person might only have to pay on the save plan, maybe like, I'm just doing this math off the top of my head, like $60, $70 a month. And with ICR, they'd be paying 20% of what is about 28,000. So what is that, like five, so maybe like 400 a month, 400 or 500 a month. So you're talking about an exponentially higher payment if you miss that deadline if you're a Parent Plus borrower. So I don't know what we're going to do between July 2024 and 2025 for Parent Plus borrowers. I think we're just going to go, you know, I don't want to be offensive, but I might go like where do retirees or, you know, older people like to vacation. I might go put an ad down in Fort Myers or something. And, you know, I guess that's more like the grandparent generation, right? Maybe, I don't know, who's like a Gen X like concert tour? Nickelback or something like that, or Celine Dion concerts. I don't know. We'll have to advertise out in front of those with like, do you have Parent Plus loans? You need to get a consult right now between 2024 and 2025. I'm trying to make this stuff entertaining, folks. I know it's not easy. So for the post July 2025 period until July of 2029, that is the Goldilocks period where the primary thing you're going to be needing to figure out is filing separate or joint, figuring out whether or not you should get off of pay onto save, and figuring out whether or not you need to be switched over to the new or old IBR plans for the cap on payments. So when is that relevant? If you're a public servant and you have a modest amount of money, or sorry, modest amount of debt versus your income, then you want to get the capped on payments so you don't have to pay way more than you want to, right? So that's really relevant. So if a lot of attending physicians that have significantly more income than debt, for example, will want to take advantage of making sure they start out with save, but then get switched over to the IBR plan before they get PSLF. But everybody else has until July of 2029 before they are required to switch off of the save plan if they want to access the new IBR plan. So that's a fairly long period of time, but here's the problem and here's the catch. What are the chances that nothing happens with student loans between 2025 and 2029? Very low. First of all, you could have a new presidential administration, one of the other party. If you do, I would almost guarantee there's going to be a negotiated rulemaking session, and the soonest they could change the existing plans would be July of 2026, because that's how long it would take to get those that guidance updated. But if you do have a Republican win the presidential election, I would say on student loan policy, it depends on who it is. If it's Trump, he probably ignores most of the things that happened. If it's somebody that's not Trump, I think that they would probably target a lot of these existing IDR plans. So what you should know is the IBR plans, income-based repayment, totally safe. It's in the statute. They can't mess with it. The repay and pay and save plans, those can be messed with because Biden has set a precedent that you can mess with them. Now, he would argue you can only make them better, but a conservative Supreme Court, which I'm certain that you would see a class action suit from borrowers saying that they can't change the plans to make them less generous, but that would go to the current Supreme Court. And what would their decision be? I don't know. So if we have Biden win the 2024 election, you probably have the save plan and all the current regulations stick around as is. And he probably wants to change the subject to something that's not student loan related, possibly. But you could also see a big compromise legislation. Say Biden were to win, say you had a Republican Senate, and say you had a Democratic House of Representatives. That's a very realistic possibility, right? You know, if you think about the House, they had a couple favorable legal decisions that make more Democratic seats that are going to get added, and that would be likely pickups for them. And then the map for Democrats in the Senate in 2024 looks pretty tough, having to defend places like West Virginia and Montana, among others. So what does that mean? I mean, so you've seen the Republicans in the Senate have said, hey, we want the repay plan just to be the one plan for everybody. And so that's a fairly moderate position compared to prior views from Republicans on income-based repayment plans. So maybe they give even more, and maybe they codify the save plan and take away some of this impermanence of these regulations. And maybe Biden's willing to do that because maybe at that point he's already won re-election and he wants to make sure that his legacy stays intact on student loans. And so he's willing to give a little bit on the level of generosity in the save plan. Maybe they rein it in a little bit. Maybe they rein in filing separate for taxes, stuff like that. So it's hard to say. But you as a borrower should know the primary thing to worry about right now is the IDR account adjustment and whether or not you should consolidate before the end of the year. That's the main thing. All these other things are fairly just, they're not tangential, but they're not as important. So that's what I would worry about for now. One thing that we're committed to, we've got an extreme backlog right now with consults. We are trying to do our very best, adding a bunch of new consultants, training them up. That takes time. So we can't just drop on a dime and add 20 people, because the quality wouldn't be as good. And the quality is the most important thing to us in terms of the advice that we offer. So we're working really hard on that. Hopefully by the time this comes out, you'll be able to get another consult from us much sooner than we've had. So that's studentloanplanner.com/book. That's what you want to go to if you want to get a plan with us. And then studentloanplanner.com/voicemail if you'd like your questions to be featured in next time we do an episode like some of the listeners on today's show. Thanks so much. And until next time, I'm Travis with Student Loan Planner.